Good afternoon and welcome to Issues and Ideas. I'm Larry Rutter, this week's host.
To walk through the caves and it's dark and you have to wear a headlamp and you hear water cascading through and then you emerge out into the beautiful pinnacle spires and the amazing landscape that you can see here.
This week, we're going to explore an exotic wilderness that you may not know is in your own backyard.
Presenting Bill Cosby was quite a thrill for me. And on a personal level, I got to hang out with Bill for just he and I backstage for probably an hour and a half between shows, which was really fun.
We'll go behind the scenes at the Performing Arts Center with Cal Poly Arts.
We've learned that people love their open space. They're very dedicated to the open space, think that that's really one of the main things that gives San Luis Obispo its culture and its identity is our physical setting and really wanting to make sure the city knows how important that is and to maintain it and help it grow.
Also today, we'll offer a glimpse of what could be the future for the city of San Luis Obispo.
From our survey, what surprised a lot of us was how many women said they weren't comfortable understanding economic issues and really wanted more financial training.
Today's program, we offer some insight into a very ambitious attempt to help with the unique needs of women in our community. All that and more on this edition of Issues and Ideas. Until recently, the only thing I knew about the Pinnacles National Monument was the signs along Highway 101 around Soledad announcing east and west entrances to what looked to my untrained eye to be distant, arid mountain foothills. Then I had occasion to spend a few days camping and hiking there, and a whole new exotic and beautiful world opened up to me. The Pinnacles, I realized, is a little-known natural treasure right in our own backyard. Then I learned it was about to be upgraded from monument to a national park, and that really piqued my interest. What does this mean for its neighbors and newly found friends? So I picked up the phone, and with me on the line is the superintendent of Pinnacles National Park, Karen Bepler-Dorn. Welcome to KCBX, Karen.
Hi, Larry. It's nice to be with you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. All right, let's start out by giving those who are like I was until a couple years ago, ignorant about the Pinnacles, let's give us a verbal picture of what we would see out there in the distance as we pass by.
Pinnacles National Monument, as you mentioned, is located right here in California's beautiful Central Coast region, and it's a part of the Gabalon Mountain Range, and as part of that mountain range, it's got a unique place in that Pinnacles is a little piece of a volcanic system. And that volcanic system that formed millions of years ago, half of it traveled along the San Andreas Fault to the location of Pinnacles, where it is now, and eroded away and has made these magnificent spires that of rock that you can see when you hike in the park. And the other half is 200 miles to the south and is just basically rolling California hills. So there's a very unique volcanic geologic system that you can view here at the park. And because of that, we have a lovely oak savanna chaparral ecosystem. And many, many people love to come here in the spring to see the beautiful wildflower displays that are present, and also migrating birds in the spring and fall.
What would be, if we went there, kind of our biggest surprise?
It provides a sense of adventure. There's these lovely canyons up into the hills that you can follow along stream courses, and at least some of them run with water even in the hottest parts of summer. And they cascade down, one of them cascades down through the Bear Gulch Caves, and that's a great experience to walk through the caves, and it's dark and you have to wear a headlamp and you hear water cascading through, and then you emerge out into the beautiful pinnacles, spires, and the amazing landscape that you can see here.
Karen, are there any exotic wildlife, things that might surprise us nestled in between these rocks and caves and lakes and whatnot?
Well, Pinnacles, of course, is one of three release sites for the endangered California condor here in the United States. And so at certain times of year, for sure, you can definitely see condors flying over, free flying over the Pinnacles. And there's only about 300 condors in existence today, and 200 are in the wild. So having the chance to see some California condors free flying in the skies over the Pinnacles is just an exciting experience.
Hey, what do you think is the greatest environmental threat to the park right now?
National parks are small slices out of the area, small pieces of open land out of the areas where they exist. And one of the key things that we look towards doing is working with park neighbors and communities and other land managers on protecting the habitats that surround the park. Since we're just a little piece of the area, we need to work closely with our local communities, counties, local government, private landowners, all in a cooperative way to manage lands to protect the valuable natural and cultural resources of the area where we exist. So we try to do that in a cooperative fashion.
We're talking with Karen Bepler-Dorn, who's superintendent of what will soon be Pinnacles National Park. Going from being a monument to a national park, is that going to make a difference in your job, in the job of the park, in the way the park is run in its future?
Well, all units of the National Park Service. So currently, Pinnacles is a national monument. It's managed in much the same way as a national park would be. So all units of the National Park Service are managed to preserve and protect the natural and cultural resources located within the boundaries, protect those for the benefit of future generations, and provide for visitor enjoyment. So overall management of the national park will remain the same as for the national monument. We're going to continue to protect the wildlife here in the park and the natural features such as the Talus Caves I mentioned earlier and some of our cultural heritage places. We have some historic farms and homestead buildings here in the park. The protection of all of those will remain the same.
Do you expect, with the designation as a national park, that tourism is going to increase?
Mm-hmm. I've talked with other superintendents whose parks have gone through this change from national monument to national park, and that's one thing that keeps coming up is we anticipate with the national park name, Pinnacles National Park, that it does attract a greater interest from the tourism community, in particular travel writers, and that in turn leads to more people learning about the park and maybe making their vacation plans around, we're going to go see the national parks. We're going to see Yosemite, Sequoia. We're going to be in California. Let's go see that Pinnacles National Park. Also, the newness of it, being a new national park, we expect that to draw some increased interest as well. It's my understanding that foreign visitors, they often gear their travels to seeing at least some of those 58 national parks. Because of that name designation, it raises up their interest, and so we do expect maybe some additional increased foreign travelers.
One of the things that you've been involved in is putting together a general management plan for Pinnacles, whether it's a national park or a monument. What's the status of that plan, and do you see it being affected by national park status?
Really, no. The general management plan that is available to the public for review, it considered many things that the legislation considered in uplifting the national monument to a national park. We considered the management of those same things, such as the cultural resources and the farmsteads and homesteads, and providing increased visitor opportunities here at the park. So really it won't change.
One of the things that I gathered from skimming the report, at least the executive summary, is that there's you look at several different alternative ways to go in the general management of the park. Mm-hmm. And one was your alternative D, which was kind of the favored alternative. Can you characterize what that alternative would be in terms of the future management of the park?
Yes. So alternative D is the agency preferred alternative, and we call that linking people and resources. And in that alternative, we provide some increased visitor opportunities. We look towards providing increased visitor opportunities, such as a new trail system in an area we call the Bottomlands, perhaps adding some backcountry campsites. And we look at increasing our interpretive programs about cultural resources, particularly those homestead sites I mentioned. And we take a look at finding ways to connect people to the natural resources through outreach programs to our local communities and educational programs, increasing some of our educational program opportunities. So really helping the American public connect with the park and the resources and the stories they tell.
Well, when he does sign the bill, do you expect any special celebration locally?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we're already starting to work on planning that. So there's quite a bit that'll go into it, and I'll make sure we get the information out to folks as we know more about it.
All
and
right.
Definitely the public will be invited to celebrate along with us.
Well, it's a great place to celebrate. Pinnacles National Monument, Pinnacles National Park. I can tell you it is a hidden and often unrecognized gem along what we think of as the Central Coast of California. And I think you're quite honored to be the superintendent of that. It's a fine place. Karen?
Oh, absolutely. I can't tell you how excited I am to be here at Pinnacles during this new era in its history.
All right. Karen Bepler-Dorn, Superintendent, Pinnacles, thank you very much for visiting with us this afternoon.
Oh, thank you for the opportunity to talk with you.
Since we talked with Superintendent Bepler-Dorn last week, President Obama signed a law officially designated our Pinnacles as a national park. You're listening to Issues and Ideas here on Public Radio KCBX. I'm your host this week, Larry Rutter. Coming up at 2 o'clock is one of our new programs entitled On Being with Krista Chippett, a program that engages listeners across the spectrum of belief and non-belief in conversation about life's deepest questions.
We've learned that people aren't as afraid of roundabouts as we thought they might be.
Coming up here on Issues and Ideas, we're going to talk about a very interesting effort by the city of San Luis Obispo that you might say is trying to plumb the psyche of the community. And we find out how some people have organized to address the special needs of women in our community. Guest is someone whose career is in largely live theater, not as a performer, but as someone who makes it all happen behind the scenes. He majored in drama in college, directing theater in graduate school, and has held significant positions in theater management at the Lake Tahoe region and in Seattle and environs. For the last 5 years, he's been the head of Cal Poly Arts, a major user of the Performing Arts Center here in San Luis Obispo. Welcome, Steve Lurian.
Thanks, Larry. Good to be here.
You know, it seems to me the staggering variety of performances that you are the maestro of in a given year, the variety from small little one-man shows to major musicals.
Well, yeah, it's a big load. You know, we're not in a major metropolitan area, so we sort of take it on as our responsibility to provide the total breadth of the performing arts opportunities for people to consume here in the Central Coast.
Your relationship of Cal Poly Arts to the PAC. Mm-hmm. I described you as one of the major users.
That's correct.
But you are not the Performing Arts Center. You are an adjunct to the university with the mission of?
Of providing content for the Performing Arts Center, really. The Performing Arts Center is an entity all its own. It's actually operated by Cal Poly Arts, but operated by Cal Poly, and it's overseen by a commission that is made up of the three partners that built it, which was Cal Poly and the City of San Luis Obispo and the private foundation, the Foundation for the Performing Arts Center. That's not us. Actually, Cal Poly Arts is a department in the College of Liberal Arts, which is, you know, just so I'm sort of akin to the chair of the English department, for example. And our role, however, rather than educating students directly, is to provide, 40 to 50 performances in the Performing Arts Center each year.
The mechanics of running the Performing Arts Center, stagehands, mm-hmm. Lighting, electricity, the whole thing that goes into it, what is your relationship with that? I mean, are you interface with the people that do that are part of the PAC itself?
Well, yes, I do, absolutely. They're not under my control. I'm essentially a client of the Performing Arts Center, just like the symphony is a client of the Performing Arts Center. I rent the facility and all of the people that come along with it. Obviously, I am the largest consumer of dates and am the largest client. I think we create about a third of the programming dates and probably about, close to two-thirds of the earned revenue that the Performing Arts Center earns through our programming. But interestingly, when the operating mandates for the Performing Arts Center were set up, there was a concern that Cal Poly Arts or Cal Poly in general might dominate the programming. So it was made very clear within the operating mission of the facility that the community gets priority on dates. So before I can pick dates for my events, the symphony and the dance companies and the, choruses and actually the music department at the university all pick their dates, and then I have the calendar open to book other things.
I understand you are in the process right now of putting your next season together, if I got that right?
That's correct.
All right. Go through with us what it takes to put together a program for a year for an organization like this.
Sure. We have a big giant whiteboard, honestly, and about 100 artists or companies up on it right now. And it's an interesting balancing act of trying to get the most for what we have to spend. A mix of well-known entities, artists, household names, performers like William Shatner we've got coming up, we had Eddie Izzard, and we've got the Blue Man Group, things like that, mixed with things that we want to introduce the community to that they may not know that, you know, to discover a new favorite. You know, there's a balance there. We also have two venues, Cohan Center, which is 1,289 seats, and we also present in the Spanos Theater, which is about 500 seats. So finding artists that are appropriate for both of those venues, and it's roughly 3/4 of our presenting happens in the Cohan Center and about 1/4 in the Spanos, because we share the Spanos with the theater and dance department, who take up the majority of the dates in there. So we only have a few windows within the year that we can present there. Mm-hmm. The process is we start going to booking. I go to 3 booking conferences a year. One is for California presenters only. It's kind of that happens in June. It's sort of a recap of the past year and ideas for next year, and it's just presenters only. And then in September, the first sort of out of the gate, start booking for the following fall. We go to the Western Arts Alliance Conference. It's, you know, somewhere in the West. Next year it's in L.A. Last year it was in Denver. Essentially a trade show. There are scores of showcases that you can see to introduce yourself to new artists, or a lot of artists you don't know, so you get to see a lot of new stuff. You spend a lot of time in appointments with agents. Then there's taking into consideration the routing. Artists are on tour, you know, the Blue Man Group, you're not going to just get them to fly out here from New York and perform for 2 days and fly home. They've got to be in a route. You've got to make that work. Broadway shows are the big deal there, because it's got to fit right into some niche that makes it work. And we are in an advantageous location in many ways, even though it feels like we're very isolated. The good news is that we're halfway between San Francisco and Los Angeles. Lots of tours they can't make it to do a show in San Francisco one night and get to LA in time to set up, tech a show, and do it the next night. So a perfect stop off is for them to drive 3 or 4 hours from LA or San Francisco to here, set up a show, do it that night, then get up the next morning and drive to the other, whichever, north or south, to get to the other major venue. Mm-hmm. So we luck out in those terms, because we fall into a lot of artists at prices that we better can afford here because of our location.
Also, isn't there also a forum in New York, too, of performers as well?
Last Friday we had Hair. On the next day, I got up and flew to New York for several days for the Arts Presenters Conference, which is the national conference that has roughly 1,000 presenters like myself and a similar number of agencies and people representing artists.
You talked about an event that takes place in June, one that takes place in September,
right,
and then this one taking place
now
in January.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, once you go to this event in January,
right,
you've got all the intelligence you need to begin to put together your schedules.
Yeah.
Have I got that right?
Yeah. And so usually once we get back from New York, we have probably 2 months to complete the season.
Do you have a
formula?
A formula.
Uh-huh.
That's it.
Sure.
Do you have one?
Well, to some degree. We have, roughly 3 or 4 Broadway shows a year now. And that seems to be about the right level. Once you kind of get those pieces in place, then you look for some headliners, people that you think you can have on the cover of your brochure that people recognize their face. Usually, 4 or so dance slots. Then you have probably 4 or 5 classical music slots. So you start adding all those things up, and you come up with a lot of different performances. And then you try to sort of throw them all up against the wall and look to see if it's balanced. If you have enough big names, then sort of at the 11th hour, you're going, I think we need another headliner or two to really make this work. Or we're really weighted toward one genre or another. We need to, fill this out. So, it's kind of just it's a big...
Steve Lurian is our guest here, and we are talking with him because he's head of the Cal Poly Arts. In the 5 years you've been doing this, what is the moment that stands out that was the most exciting or the most satisfying?
Last year, we partnered and brought Crosby, Stills, and Nash to the Performing Arts Center, and that was, they were my they were and still probably are my favorite band of all time. So that has to be right up there in the highlights. Also, presenting Bill Cosby was quite a thrill for me. And on a personal level, I got to hang out with Bill for just he and I backstage for probably an hour and a half between shows, which was really fun. And in fact, I went up, and if you've been to the Performing Arts Center, you've seen I get up there pretty much every time and do some curtain speech, thank the sponsors, introduce the artists, etc. He came out on stage and surprised me while I was out there, and we did a 5-minute dog and pony show where he was talking to me about how much he loves jazz, and we were about to go into a jazz series, right, or sort of a little jazz festival right after that. So doing a dialogue with Bill Cosby on stage was definitely a career highlight for me.
All right, what's the low light?
Well, we've had some shows that, didn't meet my expectations, let's say. And I'm not going to go into names.
Oh, come on.
Oh, no.
It's just you and I talking.
Well, we had a dance program last spring. Let's just say that it wasn't what I expected. I was embarrassed, to a large extent. And, it wasn't terrible, but it wasn't what we advertised because we didn't understand what they were talking about. And the quality of the dance wasn't that great. So that was probably the low light for me.
Well, I suppose one of the problems is that sometimes you buy a pig in a poke.
Uh-huh.
You think what you're getting, but you don't have any direct experience of it. And
right.
You take a chance on it.
Yeah. We do everything we can to see pretty much everything live before we present it. But that's obviously, problematic because, they may be a company from Nebraska and getting there to see it is not easy. So fortunately in our technological age here, we have the opportunity to see full performances of the work typically, but other times not so much.
We're talking with Steve Leary, and he's head of Cal Poly Arts. Do you guys make money? Do you turn a profit?
No. We generate, just kind of in broad figures here, it costs about $1.8 million or so to run our operation, of which about $900,000, $850,000 are artist fees, and the rest goes to the PAC and marketing and, all that stuff. And we generate around $1.2 million in sales. So the rest we need to make up through contributions and support of other kinds. So we raise money just like any other nonprofit.
But you do pay rent to the PAC so that they get the rent.
Oh, yeah.
So that's part of your mission, actually.
Yes, it is. To support there. Without our programming, the PAC would be in, that would not be a good scenario for them.
Do you get any complaints or a lot of complaints about the price of tickets?
Not a lot, but we do get complaints about the price of tickets. This year we switched to a new system that there are no add-on charges. So what you see advertised and in our brochure, that's exactly the price you're going to pay, including So there used to be facility fees or there used to be, if you bought online, it cost you an extra $5. Phone calls was extra. Everything was extra, including parking. Now what you pay, including what you don't pay for parking anymore. The PAC sponsors the parking. And so consequently there is a fee that's built into the price that you're paying. It's all included, so there's no there's no surprises.
Well, that surprises me because I wasn't aware that was the policy.
We just started that this year.
Oh, I think it's excellent.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
excellent.
We've gotten great feedback on that. But understandably, it's not inexpensive to attend shows. It's not the price of a movie. But as I just told you, we pay about $900,000 in artist fees a year, and that money's got to come from somewhere. Cal Poly's not in a position to underwrite gigantic losses that we might have otherwise.
Yeah, I'll give you a chance here to promote in the next week or the next several weeks or month. Anything in particular that you'd like to make sure we know about?
Sure. Actually, coming up this weekend, We have a really interesting opportunity to see a one-man show with William Shatner. Shatner's world, you just live in it. And so that's coming up this Saturday night. I have Garrison Keillor coming up in the near future. Of course, a close tie to, NPR.
Right.
That Garrison's coming up on February the 13th.
And that's a one-man show, isn't it?
That's just him at the microphone. We also have maybe the biggest musical we've ever had at Cal Poly coming up, Disney's Beauty and the Beast in March. And then, of course, something I've been working on since I got here, we mentioned it earlier, the Blue Man Group, which, you know, is quite a coup for us because they typically do not play smaller markets, only major metropolitan areas. And we've just beat them to death. We finally wore them down and got them here for two performances coming up in April.
That's really exciting. Mm-hmm. You've got an exciting program. It's a major part of our cultural and entertainment community. You ought to be very proud of it. And we are proud that Steve Lurie and you've been able to join with us today.
Well, it's great talking to you, Lurie. Thanks very much for having me.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. I'm your host this week, Larry Rutter. A programming note, don't forget KCBX now offers all the day's business, financial, and economic news every weekday on Marketplace, coming up today at 4 o'clock. In a bit, we're going to talk with someone you may never have heard of, but who definitely has made and will continue to make a very big difference in our nonprofit and charitable communities. But first, some months ago, I read that the city of San Luis Obispo was updating its master plan and wanted public input, and my eyes didn't linger very long. I suppose it was the image common to most government so-called input, an interminable public hearing with people droning on and on, everyone having their own personal agenda, and nobody really listening. And then I had occasion to look closer and realize that this was not that way at all. The city seemed to be really wanting to know what people thought, and were using some very innovative ways to find that out. So we wanted to find out more. With us in the studio is the person who can tell us all about it. She's Kim Murray. She's Deputy Director of Long-Range Planning for the City of SLO. Welcome, Kim.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Kim has a master's in city and regional planning from Cal Poly. She's worked for both the county and worked for the city for the last 10 years. We'll get back to the detail, or we'll get to the detail in a moment, Kim. But first, in this last workshop that you had, I think was in early December, about the city plan, you used some very interesting ways to get people to express themselves about the city. So let's just describe some of those methods you used that weren't just public hearing in front of a bunch of sleeping elected officials.
I'd be happy to talk about it. We had a great public hearing in December, a great workshop. We actually called it a future fair because it's really hard to think about what San Luis Obispo should be like in the year 2035. It's a great place to live. We want to keep all the wonderful things that are working now, but how do you get people thinking in the future as opposed to what's happening now? And so we used a couple different tools. We used an online tool called Mind Mixer, which is still operational. And
right.
That's
what's that?
It's an interactive, almost like a blog, but it's like a virtual town hall where people can log in, look at what people are talking about, improve on those ideas, add their own ideas, give specific information about certain sites in the city. It's just a really different kind of interactive tool that we are using for the first time in the city.
And what would you be looking for? What insights and how would you get insights from?
We're looking for people's ideas about how the city should grow, what sorts of types of uses they miss in the city or think should be happening in the city. We have a lot of great cultural and retail facilities, but what things are we missing? So it looks at particular locations in the city and says, what would you like to see here? We're looking at principles to kind of what sorts of things do you think should guide our decisions into the future? Just broad statements of what do you value about the community and those sorts of things. We're getting great input. We've got probably, I don't know, several hundred people who are logging on and giving us ideas and giving us input on those sites.
So it's like a standard sort of program that somebody has created, and it's basically interactive, so you can see what others are saying. You can add your own thoughts to it.
Absolutely.
What have you learned so far from that?
We've learned that people aren't as afraid of roundabouts as we thought they might be.
Oh, really?
Which is just kind of interesting from an academic standpoint, but also from how it might be implemented in the city in the future. We've learned that people love their open space. They're very dedicated to the open space, think that that's really one of the main things that gives San Luis Obispo its culture and its identity is our physical setting, and really wanting to make sure the city knows how important that is and to maintain it and help it grow.
By open space, you don't mean just the parks. You mean the outlying areas.
Exactly. The peaks, the hillsides. They want to make sure that we're maintaining views to those and also making it accessible through trails and even through the neighborhoods to those trails and connecting neighborhoods. We're hearing a lot about people who feel that they want to make sure that the connections between where they live and maybe to the downtown or where they work, that there's different ways to get there through bike trails or pedestrian walkways, or they want to have options other than just the car.
You mentioned Mind Mixer as one of the tools you used. Mm-hmm. Describe some of the other ones.
The other thing we did at that workshop, which was really fun, was we had two designers come, and they took some of these what I will call test sites, so areas of the city where we were looking for people's ideas. One of them is at the location of Santa Rosa and Foothill. It's a place where the New Frontiers Market used to be that has since moved out. And what we've heard from the neighborhood around there is they'd really like to see that area revitalized and that new uses would come in there. So we had these two designers just talking to people who showed up to say, what do you think would look good here? What would be a good use here? Do you think it should just be retail, or should there be housing mixed into that? And as people gave ideas, they actually drew these designs on paper. And you can't imagine how powerful that was for people to see their ideas really coming to life. And so it was a great energy and a great interactive process where it's not a boring meeting, as you've said, but really people seeing ideas visually. It's really powerful stuff.
We're talking with Kim Murray. She is Director of Long Range Planning. Why is a master plan, why go through the process?
It's a great question, and I will tell you that it's really difficult sometimes for people to understand how important our general plan elements, which this is what this master planning process is all about, how powerful these are for decision makers. Because when you have these elements that have policies and direction for where land uses should happen or how people can or should get around the city, those are the types of guidance that really help city councils, planning commissions, architectural review committees. That's what guides their decision making. So when a project comes in, they look to those policies to really guide them. And so even though policies may be kind of boring to talk about, when you see what ends up getting built due to those policies, that's when you really see how important those things are. And that's why we're looking for our input from our residents. So when it looks at what should our city look like, what things should be in place to help our residents get around town, where should bike trails be, where should recreational trails be, what sorts of parks should be there for our citizens, all of that is in these plans. So it's, the workshops are really important. The participation is really important because we're trying to think ahead. We're trying to think of where do we want to be in 2035 and how do we get there.
It's not just land use.
No. It's circulation as well.
And that means traffic, cars, bicycles, pedestrians.
Absolutely. What? The other thing that's really exciting about circulation, even though traffic may not seem very exciting, is that we're using, or we will be using, another new tool to help us understand how various changes to streets, corridors, intersections affect all modes of traffic.
You know, one of the things that I was fascinated when I look at your website was the study that you did, a quality of life and future development. There were some things in there that really surprised me.
How so?
Well, you're going to ask me, and I'm going to not be able to come up with the exact, but it seemed to me that it wasn't so surprising as it was very specific, I thought, in what people wanted and they didn't want. One of the things that I recall, and maybe I'm misreading it, was that there was less enthusiasm for the downtown, for instance, than I would have expected, because I think, personally, that's one of the attractions mm-hmm. of San Luis Obispo, and yet open spaces and whatnot were rated a lot higher, and the downtown was, I'm reading this, and I may have it wrong because I'm just doing it from memory, a source of some aggravation, of some unhappiness. But it seemed to me that that was a very interesting survey that you did.
We did do this survey back in March, and it was modeled on the survey that was done in 1988, which is when we last updated these two elements that we're talking about. And so we asked a lot of the same questions to gauge, has the community interest or the community values, have they changed that much over the intervening years that we need to do big changes to our guiding documents? And what we found is that not a lot has changed. People still have very strong values, as I mentioned, for open space. And downtown was one of those interesting areas that got really high marks for favorite places, but also had a lot of input about concerns. And a lot of the concerns related to homelessness issues and just maintenance of the downtown. So it's this area that we all love, but it's an area that people have flagged as needing some additional attention in a way that hasn't been the case in the past.
I may have this wrong, but it seemed to me that there was a lot of concern about drinking establishments downtown.
Yes, and it's interesting that you mentioned that because when we look at the survey, we had really similar results from the survey in 1988 that people were concerned about the amount of drinking establishments in the downtown. So I think that that's always an area where we want to make sure that we have the right mix of retail and housing and entertainment, and so that it's a good, healthy mix and not really skewed to one or the other.
So many of these processes go on, and you often lose sight of, I guess, the big picture as you're going through the process. And I'm going to ask you sort of a big picture question. At the staff level, at least, has your perception or your expectations been changed at all at this point? You said at some point in the last year or so that you've been working on this, we need to look at this a little bit differently. Hard question.
It is a very difficult question, and it's difficult because the input process isn't really completed yet. It's an ongoing process. So what we've looked at is, where are the places in these guiding documents where we as staff have identified that things need to be updated? And most of that is really from a staff level related to either legislative changes that have happened or things that we've accomplished that we want to make sure that we don't carry those outdated items forward. And so from that standpoint, I consider ourselves like midwives. We're helping birth this document for the community, but it's not a staff document. It's really the community's document.
And you're not going to say, gee, this baby is ugly.
It's going to be a beautiful baby. I can't wait to see it.
Well,
it's
your process isn't over by any means.
No, not at all.
So what happens now?
So we have really been in the data collection, looking at all of our, we have a lot of what's called GIS data, which is geographic data mapping overlays that we can look at to see what development do we have, There's also a financial piece that will be coming that says, okay, this is what you have to be a financially sustainable community. This is what you need. So we still have that analysis to go. There's still all of the development of alternatives. Now that we've heard all this information, we're going to take it back and figure out what it means and what does that mean for guiding policies going forward. Mm-hmm. And all of that is still to come. So the work that's been done to date is really just kind of setting up the table for the next meal, which is really looking in depth about our current policies, about some of these opportunities that exist for redeveloping certain sites, and then for carrying forward the vision of what people want to see into 2035.
If I'm a citizen of San Luis Obispo who didn't really realize this was going on, and I say to myself, hey, I want my input in it. Is there still an opportunity to do that? How do you do that?
Oh, absolutely. We want to hear from you. So there's a bunch of different opportunities. We have monthly task force meetings. There's a task force of 17 community members who get together every month and kind of look at our progress to date and give us input for the next steps. Those are on the third Wednesdays of every month at 6 p.m. in the community room at the library. We have a website, www.slow2035.com. There's a place where you can keep up on all of the things that have been happening, get access to materials, anything that we've had developed through workshops or task force meetings is posted there. There's also a sign-up sheet that you can sign up, and we'll send you email updates. You can contact me at the city, and I will make sure you get on the list so that you're notified. We definitely want to hear from people throughout the process and in the upcoming months.
I think it's a fascinating process, and I'm, as a citizen of the city, I'm particularly interested in what the outcomes are and what you discover. Kim Murray, thank you very much for stopping by. That's been a very useful sharing of information.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm your host this week, Larry Rutter. Don't forget that Fresh Air with Terry Gross is coming up at 3 o'clock, as it does every weekday on here on Public Radio KCBX. Number and variety of nonprofit organizations doing good things in our three-county area can be overwhelming. It's hard to focus on them. But one in particular piqued my interest when I first heard about it, especially when I learned that one of its key actors is one of our most productive community leaders, but someone who seems to fly a little below the publicity radar. So I wanted to learn more about the organization, the Women's Legacy Fund, and I wanted the pleasure of a chat with the chair of that advisory group of that fund, Ann Robinson. So welcome to KCBX, Ann.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let me tell you all a little bit about what I know about Ann. She was one of the first employees for Adobe Systems, is that correct, and served as a senior manager there until she retired and relocated to the Central Coast. She's been chair of the Slow Children's Museum during the construction of the new museum facility. She's a former director of the Opera San Luis Obispo, a former volunteer of CASA, vice president of the board of the Slow Community Foundation. As I understand it, you are likely to be elected president.
Actually, yesterday.
Oh, well, there you
Breaking
go.
News here. Yesterday, I became president of the Community Foundation.
Well, congratulations. Anyway, she is also chair of an offshoot of the foundation, the Women's Legacy Fund, which is our interest today. And I guess we have to begin with sort of the nuts and bolts for our audience. What is the Women's Legacy Fund, and how does it relate to the Community Foundation?
The Women's Legacy Fund is a fund held at the Community Foundation, and it's an endowed fund that supports programs for women and girls in the San Luis Obispo County.
Now, you create an endowment, and then what of the endowment do you use to make things happen in the community?
We use the income off the endowment. Right now, 4.25% of the actual value of the endowment we can spend every year to give out grants. Plus, actually, our luncheon and our sponsorship is profitable enough that we get a little extra that we can also grant out.
And you've been in, had the Legacy Fund, I guess, for like 10 years.
We just celebrated our 10th anniversary last September.
Over the last 10 years, what's the highlight? What is the feeling of most satisfaction in that 10-year period of time?
It's hard to pick one. Every year we've granted out money. We've granted out over $70,000 from our endowment. Plus, actually, one of the exciting things was at this last luncheon to celebrate our 10th anniversary, we did a special one-time thing that we called an impact grant where we raised money that day to give for a specific purpose, and we raised $40,000 right there at the luncheon,
which was
just really, it was really heartwarming to see that happen.
And it's not just the income from that $40,000, it's the $40,000 itself.
It's actually a little over $41,000 went directly to the Child Care Resource Center, who is starting a program to help women who have childcare businesses learn better business skills so that we pulled the people who've donated to our fund, and they said they thought childcare was one of the big issues in the county. This is kind of a twofer, because not only is it strengthening the childcare places, but the people running them, which is pretty much women on their own, are learning business skills so that they can run a better business and they have transferable business skills.
Over the last 10 years, some of the other things that you guys have done that sort of come to mind, that give people sort of an idea of what your interests are.
Well, every year we give grants in a different area. So education, economic independence, women in the social environment, and women in society are sort of how we categorize them. So one that comes to my mind is one that went to legal services for senior women. And we had a woman then tell the story of she was taking care of her granddaughter, and her granddaughter became abusive and sort of threatening. And it was through the legal services that she was able to get a restraining order to keep the granddaughter away, and otherwise she'd have been sort of stuck.
Huh.
So that was sort of one example. There are mentoring programs where we've supported high school girls mentoring younger girls to provide, to just help them out. One of the early ones was to teach business skills again to women out in the Cambria area in this people's self-help housing, to help them learn how to work in a business so they didn't have to be hotel maids, but they could move to the next economic level. And these are small programs, but we try to very much leverage the money we give so that it'll hit as many people as possible.
What was the impetus for creation of the fund? Was there something special that happened that led to its creation?
I don't know that there was any one thing locally other than the realization that women's funds are becoming very common. The fastest growing philanthropy area in the country is for women's funds and for women giving.
The list of problems that women face that might be addressed by the fund, a lot of them struck me as, well, they're children problems. They're problems that men have as well. What are the unique issues that women face that you would like to focus on?
Childcare is one. Actually, we did a study polling women in the county of what they thought were issues, and a lot of them were things specific to women. Economic independence, just understanding how to manage money. Women who've been, say, married and then find they aren't for whatever reason may have had a man managing their money and now they don't. Mm-hmm. Women still don't make as much money as men in the workplace. So there's a lot of single mothers. There's a lot of single parents, but there's a lot of single mothers. And they have, you know, all the issues that you would have raising a kid alone, especially if you didn't particularly have a good job.
Well, in the tradition, in the American tradition, women often, aren't educated in the same way. They aren't socialized in the same way that young men are to be prepared to be independent.
That's right. Yes. Women, even who think they're independent, I mean, they may be in an abusive situation or something. And that's another thing that's almost entirely a woman's problem.
As you've become involved in these things, what has surprised you? What did you think you knew or understood that kind of surprises you about the needs that women have?
From our survey, what surprised a lot of us was how many women said they weren't comfortable understanding economic issues and really wanted more financial training. And to our group, that was sort of surprising because you're talking about educated professional women. We sort of thought, well, we know how to manage money, but we were surprised at how many women didn't, even younger women.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the bigger problems, at least in the San Luis Obispo area and along the coast generally, are homeless. And yet a large proportion of the homeless people in the community are women.
Yes, they are.
And they must have special problems that need to be dealt with as well.
They are more worried about violence.
As you look ahead and think about the next year or so, what areas do you think the Women's Fund or Legacy Fund will be focusing on?
The way we set the fund up is that anyone who donates $1,000 becomes what we call a legacy leader, and they get to vote each year on what area we're going to give grants in that year. So as our legacy leaders vote, then that's the program area that we'll give grants in that year.
And in 2013, have you made your selections yet? It's pretty early in the year.
We give the grants in September. So actually, we won't be accepting grant applications until a little later this year. But all the nonprofit, all this goes is handled through the Community Foundation. Otherwise, we'd never be able to do it.
Absolutely.
And the grant applications will go out, or the information on the grants will go out sometime earlier this year so that by September we have all the grantees ready to award.
We're talking with Ann Robinson, who's the chair of the advisory committee to the Women's Legacy Fund as part of the Community Foundation. If people are interested in making a contribution or finding out what resources they might be able to tap into the foundation, how do they do that, Ann?
Probably the best way is our website. Foundation website is SLOCCF, San Luis Obispo County Community Foundation. .org. From that, you can get to the Women's Legacy Fund information, or you can go directly to SLOCCFWLF.org. But there's a lot of information there, or call the foundation office.
Do you have a personal wish list? Do you have sort of a, this is in the long term, what I'd like to accomplish with this in your own mind?
I'd like to see it grow to $1 million. We're a little over 600,000 now. I'd like to see it grow way beyond that. I don't have a specific goal. I would just, in general, like to see the problems that women and girls face addressed better. And in some ways, we're filling in some of the cracks by funding organizations that aren't, you know, that need funding for specific things. It'd be nice to see the need go away, but that's not going to happen.
Absolutely not. Women's Legacy Fund, our guest has been Ann Robinson, who's chair of the committee, and we want to thank you very much for visiting with us. It's been very interesting.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
And that wraps up Issues and Ideas for this week. We've explored our newest national park, gone backstage with Cal Poly Arts, taken a tentative peek into the future of the city of San Luis Obispo, and talked with some people focusing on the special problems of women in our community. I do hope it's been interesting and informative. But I'd be very glad to get any feedback you have on today's program. You can write me at larry@kcbx.org. This is the selfsame Larry of the Rutter family on KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast.